Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to start today by showing the Ohio gross receipts tax form. It's one page. Just got that today from Dr. Warner. And that's our goal here, is to modernize our system to get to this. We're going to start with some tax credit bills, and they all have to eventually end up in the tax credit committee, the joint tax credit committee. So let's get on it. I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 169. Get a brief summary from Chris, Electronic Commerce.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 169 is the placeholder language that moves the sunset date for the e-commerce tax credit from January 1, 2018 to January 1, 2024. To refresh people's memory, the e-commerce zone tax credit, businesses in one of the e-commerce enterprise zones is eligible for a 25% investment credit. They need to be an eligible business, and it has to be an eligible investment, basically e-commerce, internet-related. There are 15 enterprise zones in the state, and it's an overlay of the existing property tax enterprise zone program. And in the most recent year, the use of the credit has started to pick up in recent years. And in 2014, about $15 million in tax credits was claimed on personal and corporate tax returns, and about $2 million of it was used to offset liability. So it has a fair amount of carry forward. Hmm. And about, I think it was about 45 taxpayers claimed the credit.
Can you give us an example, hypothetical example?
A business that is selling products online, basically any internet-based business, as long as they're located in an e-commerce zone. So from an economic development strategy standpoint, the overlay is the existing enterprise zone program, which is a geographic focused development policy. So within this, it's not only geographically focused, it's a particular kind of industry focused. So it is a doubly targeted economic development program. So some of the issues are whether or not, if that strategy is working, whether or not it needs to stay within the current enterprise zones, if the investment tax credit could be modified somehow. Many states have an investment tax credit, but they're more broadly based. They're not necessarily tied to a specific geography within a given state. Other issues, there's another bill on the House side that expands the number of e-commerce zones. Right now, the state is limited to 15, and all 15 have been declared. So from that sense, the program is maxed out.
The e-commerce zone sort of concept came into being, 10, 15 years ago?
Correct. It was year 2000. There was a task force that looked at all kinds of business, and it was a very broad report. One of their recommendations, and I think it was a work group that met in 1999, in 2000, and when they came back in 2001, one of their recommendations was this kind of tax credit. Mm-hmm. So it was established in 2001, and for the first 10 years, it was used very sparsely. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a dozen, 15 claimants a year, and $10,000-$20,000 in tax credits. But beginning in 2010, it started to tick up.
So somebody could make the case that 17 years ago, it was a little more novel to do electronic commerce and online. Mm-hmm. Today, it's hard to imagine a business not facilitating that.
Correct.
Okay, we do have Wendy Johnson signed up to testify.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And I'm kind of the representative for all the folks that testified just the other day in the House Economic Development and Trade Committee, where an identical bill was heard, as well as a bill that both extended the sunset and then added to the zone. So the bill before you today just extends it for 6 years, the program. There are other bills in the Economic Development and Trade Committee in the House that would have expanded it. And so we're having more of that policy discussion there. But we, of course, want to support the sunset extension and move this bill, the discussion, on to the Joint Tax Committee, Credit Committee. We just didn't want no one to testify today, but more of the substance is happening on the economic development side. But as was mentioned by Chris, there's a cap now. We've hit the cap. Last year, there were more applicants that applied. It's just first in, first out. So several were denied. So Business Oregon provided testimony that North Urban Clackamas, Sandy, and West Eugene were on the list that had applied last time. And there are other cities and communities that are interested as well that can't apply because we've hit that cap. And there's the jobs report that Legislative Revenue Office has put together that shows the return on investment. And so we would like to continue that conversation in the Joint Tax Credit Committee and just ask your support today.
Senator Riley.
So when you say there's a cap, you mean there's a cap on the zones, but there's no cap on the businesses within the zones?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, there's actually a cap on the number of e-commerce zones. There's no longer a cap on the number of enterprise zones, but there's a cap on the number of e-commerce zones that overlay on top. Those are 15. There's not a cap on the number of businesses that are within the e-commerce zone. So if you're one of the 15 that have it, as long as you're in that zone, you can have more businesses that qualify. But we have over 60 some enterprise zones and only 15 e-commerce zones. So there's a lot of enterprise zones that cannot have an e-commerce zone.
Senator Buckles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can pass on this question if you want to. But you won't get to pass after today, so I'll just throw that out here. Given the discussions of a one-page form, which, you know, you've sat in the room and listened to the idea of going to a commercial activity, completely eliminating the corporate income tax, if not LLCs and partnerships or whatever, and going to a gross receipts tax or commercial activities tax, all these credits that we're discussing would go away, or would go away shortly. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I think I'm going to take that pass to let my brain noodle that one through.
Right. But as you can see, follow up, Mr. Chair, I mean, the question of just, you know, because we're talking about this, you know, do you overhaul the corporate income tax or not? I mean, it's not just an impact of saying you have the corporate income tax and you have a new tax and we get rid of this and we go to this one. It has a downrange impact on every one of these tax credits. I mean, it's sort of like your presentation the other day on property tax. It's easy to say 5 and 50, but when you start into it, there's how many slides? 30 slides? 20 slides. Right?
30.
30 slides, right. It's more complex. So I'm just telling you, I think as if we're going to go down the road of discussing what we're discussing in terms of corporate income tax overhaul, that everybody out there needs to start thinking about these other small things, because tax credits would magically either vaporize or we would phase them out over 3 years or something. Just food for thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And she's going to pass on the question. I'm fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to move into a work session on Senate Bill 179 for purposes of passing this onto the Joint Tax Credits Committee.
169 or 179?
I'm going to open up a work session on 169. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 169 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Senator Boquist moves 169 to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with no recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 166. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, 166 is the sunset extension bill for the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit. This tax credit is for lenders who make below market interest rate loans for affordable housing projects. For example, if the market interest rate is 6%, the lender can make a loan at 2%, and that 4 percentage point difference, the value of that 4 percentage point is available to the lender in form of a tax credit. And that 4 percentage point is the cap. The program does have a $17 million cap on it for outstanding credits. These loans tend to be 20-year loans, and so the value of that differential is the credit, and the sum of all the credits that are outstanding, basically a kind of liability, if you will, the cap for that is $17 million. And in talking with the housing department, we're approaching that cap, but this bill just extends the tax credit 6 years. This is one where the sunset date is not this biennium, it's January 1, 2020, but for purposes of development, it's been in the review process a cycle early, if you will. But it has the same 6-year extension, but this one is from 2020 to 2026.
Okay, thank you. Can you why are we seeing zero revenue impacts for through 19?
Through 19, because the under current law, it's still valid through 2019. So the extension, the first year that there would be a revenue impact is tax year 2020 for any loans made in 2020.
Okay.
And it's these credits tend to be 20-year credits, so there's a long tail, if you will. And so the credit builds over time. So that's why in that first biennium, it's 1 year in the 1921 biennium, it's about $500,000, and then it builds to $2.5 million in the next biennium.
So we have a 20-year lifespan.
Yeah, the credit follows the loan.
Okay, Allison, Bill, Jessica, you guys want to come up?
Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you for your time today. We just wanted to give you a brief overview of this credit. So I'm here to tell you a little bit about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, as well as some background on the need for affordable housing across Oregon. First, the Housing Alliance is a coalition of about 80 organizations from all parts of the state, and our members came together with the knowledge that everyone needs a safe, stable place to call home. And our members include a diverse set of voices, including residents, local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and organizations working to meet basic needs in every corner of our state. Today, as you likely know, we simply don't have enough affordable homes for people who need them. One in four renters in Oregon pays more than half of their income towards rent, leaving too little money left over for other basics like food, medicine, and transportation. We need additional resources and tools to build more affordable homes across the state. Included today in OLIS, we've submitted some what we call our Housing Alliance County Need Sheets, and those provide some basic information on housing costs versus wages. We included a sampling of counties, but all 36 counties are available on the website. We also included a memo from the Housing Alliance about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, providing some background information on questions asked by the Joint Tax Credit Committee, and it includes a map of all of the projects across the state where the OHTC has been used to develop them. For people with the lowest incomes, the private market simply does not provide enough affordable housing to meet demand, and over time, local, state, and federal governments have built systems and structures necessary to provide this needed housing. Those efforts have been very successful at building thousands of units across Oregon, but we have not met the need for this type of housing. We know how to build this housing in communities, but simply don't have enough resources. So the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has many benefits, including developing and preserving existing affordable housing, directly benefiting residents, and encouraging the involvement of private lenders in affordable housing. As you know, and as Chris mentioned, all state tax credits sunset, and this one is scheduled to sunset, and Senate Bill 166 simply extends the sunset. We also have a House Bill 2852, which seeks to expand the credit, and we'll hope to be back to in front of the Joint Tax Credit Committee to talk about that. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet, and I'm the Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. NOAA is a statewide nonprofit lender that provides a variety of financing programs for multifamily affordable housing projects throughout the state. We were formed in 1990 under the leadership of the Oregon Bankers Association, and we currently administer over $200 million worth of loan capital. We've financed well over 200 apartment projects throughout the state of Oregon. Those projects have leveraged over $1.2 billion worth of investments in Oregon communities. We're pleased with that result. 86% of our projects have benefited from this tax credit that has resulted in lower rents for residents at these projects. Chris did a good job explaining why we're looking at this early, but there is a 2 to 4 year development timeline for these projects, which is why we need to look at this at the extension in advance of when you might normally see an extension. The OHTC is one of Oregon's most powerful affordable housing resources, and it has been used, as Allison's map will show, in virtually every county of the state. We're pleased that over 41% of the projects financed are outside of the urban areas, and so it really does touch and provide affordability statewide. I've handed out an example. I won't go through it in great detail, but it shows the mechanics of how the program works. It shows a project in one column that would be without the tax credit, with the higher rents and the higher interest rate. Shows in the next column a project with lower rents and a lower interest rate. And then you can see the difference in the value of rent reductions for each project in that development. There's another example on there that shows the amount of capital investment that would be required up front if we didn't have this credit and we're trying to serve the same population of people at that development. So you can see we get some great benefit from that program. In most cases, the benefit is passed through in rent reductions directly to the tenants. There are two exceptions in statute to that. One is for preservation projects that have federal rent subsidies, and the other is for manufactured home parks. And in those cases, we are able to use the tax credit and increase the amount of private sector lending that helps support those projects, eliminating needs for big capital investments from the public sector. The program leverages a great amount of private capital. For every $1 million of tax credit, it results in $25 million of leverage from the private sector. And if you think it in terms of the fact that for every $25 million of loans, that develops $100 million worth of projects that come in and other capital sources, that million leads to $100 million of economic activity in our communities. So it's a very high impact program. It's an important tool, and we urge your support for extending the sunset. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Woodruff. I work for Reach Community Development. We are a nonprofit affordable housing developer, owner, and operator. Our mission is to create quality, affordable housing for people to thrive. We serve Multnomah County, Washington County, and Clark County in Washington State. The reason I'm here today is just to explain why we as an affordable housing developer use this tool. My job is to finance affordable housing development. And what we find is our main tool to do that in our country is the federal low-income housing tax credit, which was designed to serve people at 60% of area median income. But in our community and statewide, and in Washington State as well, what we find is that the community needs data shows that people, even at that level, often are rent burdened, and we really have a need for much lower income housing in the community. We also, with the tenants in our existing housing, we have about 2,200 units, and we also find that people tend to pay more than 30% of their income, even in affordable housing. So when the reason we use this tool is it gives us the ability to utilize that federal low-income housing tax credit, but then better serve the needs of our community. So when we are developing new housing, we look at what the real needs are, and we pair the state tax credit with the federal tax credit for more benefit for the community. Because we work in Oregon and Washington, I think we have the unique perspective of how powerful this tool is. It's very simple for us to use, but allows us to address a community problem that exists, like I said, in both states. But Oregon has this tool that really gets directly to that need, and Washington does not have something similar. So just to give a quick example of how effective it is for us, it really works for so many different types of projects. So just in the last few years, to give you an idea of who this has the ability to serve, we have completed Gilman Court, which is a new construction senior project in Portland, Gray's Landing, which is new construction for workforce and veterans at risk of homeless in Portland, Orchard of Ranco, new construction workforce in Hillsboro, and then in my time at Reach, in 8 years, we've also used this tool to preserve existing affordable housing, most notably 100% Section 8 projects for the elderly and disabled, and it's been a very powerful tool to help us do that as well. So we're just here to seek your support. Thank you.
Thank you. just can you remind me what the audit function is for banks to make sure that this that they derive no financial benefit?
Yeah, so the way that the credit works is they have to, with their tax return, they submit, essentially it's the mathematical computation that shows what the foregone interest is, and then that determines the amount of the tax credit they can claim each year. And then the department, Oregon Housing and Community Services, also does a compliance check with the owners of the projects to make sure that the rents are being passed through in an amount equal to that interest savings. So it gets checked in both on both ends of the process.
Very good. Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, this is not your bailiwick, I got that, but I understand your point. Can any of the three of you at liberty to give us an example of the actual taxpayers, the lenders that are taking this credit, or can you at least characterize, at least to my left, your right, characterize the type of entity? Or are they mostly banks, private investment companies, mortgage companies? Who's really doing this at the taxpayer, or the tax filing? All the taxpayers are doing this, but at the tax filing, who is the actual type of corporation, LLC? I mean, I know there's about three dozen of these, but do we have a characterization or some real-world examples?
So in statute, it has to be a regulated financial institution in Oregon. To my knowledge, through our program at least, and we're a significant participant in the program, they're all Oregon banks.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Thank you for this one-pager here. It's very helpful, and I liked the example. I was just wondering if you could, do you know how many households or units or however you count them are benefiting from this? Do you have a sense of how far? I'm just curious.
Senator Taylor, I believe in OLIS we also submitted a list of projects that were financed since 1989 with the credit, and we can certainly follow up and get you a total unit with some household characteristics if that would be helpful.
I was just curious about how many people, the actual families that were benefiting from. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Riley?
So the sale of the tax credits to the banks, and I know that they are in all cases, not just yours, almost all banks that buy these. how much do you get in actual dollars for your tax credits?
Senator Riley, thank you. That's a great question. This is a really unique tax credit, and then the fact that it's not capitalized and sold like many tax credits are. It is a function of the loan, and so it's passed through each year. In that interest reduction is calculated each year, and that's the amount of the credit that the bank claims. It's equal to their foregone interest earnings. It is dollar for dollar that way. So it's dollar for dollar, and then that interest savings also then materializes in reduced rent. So it's really one of the great things about the program is that every dollar of tax credit results in a dollar or more of reduced rents to the low-income tenants. There's no profit taking at the bank level or at the developer level the way the program is structured.
So my understanding, and I just toured one of the facilities that's being reclaimed in Hillsboro, and they're doing a great job of fixing that up and making it available for low-income folks. And it's got a whole floor for disabled, and that's, and it's got one bedroom, two bedroom, and three bedroom for families. It's really a great project that's going on out there. And my understanding, when I talked to the people there, is that they're actually getting more than a dollar of worth for that dollar that we give in tax credits. It's more like a dollar and a quarter in interest reduction that they're actually getting.
How is that mathematically possible?
Yeah. Well, the banks are taking a loss. That's what it comes down to.
Well, I think there's two tax credits, and one is the federal tax credit that Jessica spoke about, and banks actually do pay more than a dollar for the capital infusion on that federal tax credit.
Federal, okay.
So I think it's probably the federal one. I do think we get overall more than a dollar for dollar in rent reductions, because every sponsor that I know of builds in a buffer to make sure that they don't fall out of compliance. And so that's an exercise of just conservative management practices. So even on the Oregon credit, I do believe it's more than dollar for dollar. I can't tell you how much.
I think so. Thank you.
I do have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bocus.
I just want to clarify for the record to make sure we're all talking, at least in the apple categories, you know, granny apple, delicious red, or whatever, right? And not apple and granny. Senator Riley raised the issue of, you know, they're bought and sold, which they're not, as was clarified in the deal. But in terms of the tax credit itself, it's the differential in the interest rate. So hypothetically, you have a 1% interest rate. Then there's a calculation formula made from that 1% interest rate. Say, hypothetically, this is not the right number. I know what the right number is, but you'll get confused for the record. If you have $100,000 that is the value of that interest rate, that is then converted over to another calculation in which that is amount, which is about three or four times the amount, and that's what you use for rent control, correct? Because obviously this is a credit, and they're reducing their actual taxes owed based on the credit. And the calculation to ensure that the two sides balance isn't the 1%, it's the calculation of the benefit to the financial institution. Is that not correct?
Senator Boquist.
Or you can restate it, because you know how this works and I don't.
Well, and I'd be happy to spend as much time as you'd like on it. I've got about a 4-page spreadsheet that shows the math in great detail, more than you probably would ever want to see to
right.
get to those calculations. But in general, because loans amortize over that 20-year period, the amount of interest changes and the amount of the actual credit changes, but they have to make, for the owner's sake, they have to make that a fixed credit that passes through. So that credit, the rent reduction, I'm sorry, that passes through. So that's fixed over time. But when you take the life of the 20-year loan, every dollar of the tax credit does go to the form of rent reductions. And I'm hoping I'm getting to your question on that.
No. But that's okay. That's okay. That's
okay.
Fine. Are you ready for a motion, Mr. Chair, unless somebody else has a question?
Senator Bartschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my perception is there's a federal program and a state program. So when we reconcile the tax credits to the rent reduction, do we blend those two together to reconcile, or are they reconciled separately?
Senator, they are separate. So we do, as developer owner, we go to the Oregon Housing Community Services for both credits, and they have an oversight function over both credits, but they are otherwise separate. The federal low-income housing tax credit is how we get our equity. So we get cash from the banks. We sell those tax credits and actually get cash. Whereas the credit we're talking about today is the lender tax credit. So it's really just a reduction of our permanent loan interest rate in exchange for us committing to lowering the rents that we charge our tenants. So they are beyond just our applying for them and being have the oversight from the Oregon Housing Community Service. They otherwise are totally separate. Right?
Yeah, Senator, and I'll just add on that's, that in the example on the back of the handout that I gave, you'll see one column at 60% and the other column at 50. So, for instance, the federal tax credits make the project automatically operate at 60%. And then Oregon Housing is careful to layer on, it's a layer, it's an additive process where they layer on then this other Oregon credit to drive those rents from 60, which is the federal requirement, down below. And in this case, it's 50.
So with that being said, is there any financial gain for the lending institution or the developers if you look at both of them together?
Senator, I would say that'd be a great question for the financial institutions that are doing the claiming. I think there is a gain on the federal program. That's why they make those investments. There's not a gain on the Oregon program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're in work session, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 166 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, and I'll speak to the motion, and I should have spoke to the previous motion in the previous hearing, too, but I didn't. Sorry.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 166 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should have explained in the last committee, and I didn't this time. The reason I'm making the motions without recommendation is simply the fact that when it goes over to the Joint Committee, now we've got to prioritize all these. There's all kinds of other things and intricacies that go into this, and rather than, you know, vote, have one person vote no to say we're not done discussing this, I'm just trying to make this unanimous that, okay, we probably all in theory at least agree that this is a good program. How it might work or another one might work is a little bit different when you get in on this priority mix of all these tax credits that are coming. That's why I'm making the motions without recommendations, even though I'm personally supportive of this program. I'm trying to give us some balance when we get with our House colleagues and it turns into a food fight. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well said, except for the food fight part.
It will be, and it has been, Mr. Chair.
No calorie.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Senate Bill 166 goes to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. Thank you, three. And, Bill, this is an excellent one-pager and an excellent example of what a good summary should be. Thank you. I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 171. We held a hearing on this last week. It was largely an administrative function on fire insurance. Senator Boquist, do you want to send this to the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 171 to the Joint Tax Committee without recommendations. I'll speak to the motion.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 171 to the Joint Tax Credits Committee without recommendation. Discussion, Senator Boquist.
If you want to go back in the tape, you can see my discussion earlier why we're doing it without recommendation. The only other comment I have interesting on 171 is I do think, and not this session, Mr. Chair, I do think when we dreamed up this way of doing this, I don't know, 20, 30, or 40 years, there was a better way to do it than the way we're doing it right now, but that's for another complete legislative session. We could accomplish it a better way than this, but that's okay. I'm fine.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Senate Bill 161 also goes to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits without recommendation. So because we're on this theme of tax credits, let's move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 161. Director Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 161 really comes from discussions that we have had during the interim and actually over the years with the Department of Revenue Research Section about the tax expenditure report. Of course, they are the ones that are responsible for the big book. And if you look at that report, in the beginning is the definition of tax expenditure and what's to be included in it. And that's in statute. It was grew out of the Revenue Committee in 95, and Department of Revenue has been preparing this report along with the governor's budget each biennium since 97-99. I guess the issue we had, or we've talked about, is there a way to make the report and maybe some statutory changes around the definition that might make it more useful to you as a policymaker. Specifically, the concerns we've had is there's, you know, at times I think the perception becomes you look at very large numbers, and it's kind of that a tax expenditure is a tax expenditure. In other words, there's some homogeneity there, which in fact they're very different, and particularly they're very different in terms of your ability to actually change them. And the implications of that. So our thinking is maybe there would be some way to have definitions in the report that would have more have a subset that would be more under your control. The examples I'm thinking about are, for example, on the federal tax policy, and you are, as you know, connected to the federal taxable income, and changes in the federal tax base flow through and influence the Oregon base. But there are really two types of major federal tax expenditures. One are the deductions, which is something you can disconnect from and can influence, and you should be able to do that in an administratively feasible way. The other thing is exclusions, which are those types of income that are not reported on the federal tax return. And I think the administrative ability to reach out and try to capture those and to ensure compliance is a lot different than it is for the deductions. So one is a lot more feasible policy than the other. The other example we think about has come to some of the components of the property tax expenditures. And the classic example there is federal land. Well, I mean, is that something that's really within the purview of our legislature? Probably not. So and I know the Department of Revenue has looked at this, one of they have found that there's some definition or some adjustments made in the tax expenditure report in Minnesota, for example, where it's more reflective of the policy levers that you have at your control. So that's our reason for doing that, just to open the discussion. We do have the department here. Mm-hmm. Tim Fitzpatrick from the Revenue Research Unit is here. He's done a lot of work on this year's report, and he reported to the committee back in December. So we're open for discussion on that, on this, and if something you want us to pursue, we could certainly do that. If not, we don't need to.
All right, well, let's bring up, is it Fitzpatrick or Fitzgerald? Fitzpatrick.
That's 78% of the land base in my county being federal.
Yeah. Chair House, members of the committee, my name is Tim Fitzgerald. I'm an economist with Department of Revenue Research Section. Yeah, there's Mary Fitzpatrick in our same section.
Mary Fitzpatrick. So,
I don't normally testify, and I don't have much to say on this particular, but I definitely wanted to be open for questions or if you had anything you'd like to chat with us. Our main thing here was, as Paul very clearly stated, the definition of tax expenditures. Very broad. It's very inclusive of a lot of things. And, you know, for reporting purposes, we put a lot into the book. And, you know, 367 this last time, and that's a lot of different things to include. And a lot of them, as you said, not everybody finds particularly useful for policy discussions. Available for discussion.
Well, part of it is the staff. I mean, you don't have staff to thoroughly vet and audit these programs. And so that's, it seems to me that that's why we often get these conclusions that say, it appears to be, you know, working. It appears to be.
A large number of them we don't. Sorry, Chair House. A large number of them we don't get evaluations for, in particular because they're very small, or in some ways we're not even sure who would evaluate them. Yeah. It can be like the intangible property for several years was in the intangible personal properties in the book for several years. We had no idea who would be considered the right organization or anybody to evaluate whether it's working.
Yeah. And that's what would be most useful, I think, is something you probably can't provide, which is, you know, something that says, well, this worked back in, you know, 2000 when there was a shortage of e-commerce, but now that everybody does it, it seems to be outliving its use. You know, those kinds of, that kind of commentary. And I'm not even sure that's the best thing to do because, you know, that's your opinion. And it gets sort of necessarily complicated, like so many other things in our committee. Mm-hmm. Senator Boquist?
Yes,
Mr. Chair, along the same theme that we started out this meeting, I'll ask Paul, and he can answer the question, and it's Tim, right? Mm-hmm. And then Tim can chime in if he wants to, or I'll give him a pass like I did the cities. This book is, I don't know, approximately 1¾ inches thick. Mm-hmm. Right? So, Paul, if we went to the one-page tax form, commercial activity tax versus an income, corporate income tax, assuming it covers LLCs, LLPs, and some other people, how many inches do we get rid of in this book right here if we just sunset them all at like
still got sole proprietors
3 years or something along that line?
Mr. Vice Chair, I think that, you know, there would be some some reduction, but you know, just about all of the tax expenditures that you have that are related to the corporate income tax are also related to personal income tax. So those that are filed in the person. So there would be a number of those tax expenditures that would be a lot smaller in their impact, but would still be in the book and still have some impact. So I think there would be some reduction on those that are specific to the corporate income tax. The other thing, of course, what would happen over time is if you were to go to an alternative tax base, then you would start a new chapter at the back. It would be tax expenditures for that. So that, of course, would be under control of how that grows, but that's typically what you see. And that would be, for example, with the CAT, the way it operates in Ohio now, nonprofits are exempt. So that would be a tax expenditure. You'd have to, if you follow the CAT base, the way that it's implemented in Ohio, that would be a tax expenditure that would be reported here. So I think the short answer is, yeah, I think it would shorten it some, but in terms of pages, probably not a lot, but in terms of impact and dollar impact, I think it would.
Hello, Tim.
Oh, do you want to jump in?
If you don't mind,
please. Chair, while we're discussing this,
we actually have. There are only 16 tax expenditures that are corporation only, mm-hmm. and of those, 3 are tax credits that are exclusive to corporations. If I'm reading my own work correctly, which I hope I am, so we would be eliminating very, very small number by switching to that and eliminating all those related ones. And of course, I always try to point out the details matter a lot. Carry forwards and everything else, there's a lot of contractual kinds of ways that these are structured, and you wouldn't want to just presume that they would instantly disappear, regardless of how drastic a change you make to the system.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're not presuming, we just might do it anyway, because this is legislation, right? I have to remind my colleagues in the transportation side when we listen to all our fine executive branch people, well, this statute says you can't do this, and this statute can't share. We have something called notwithstanding that can just solve that problem instantaneously, and if you really want to get us irritated, we'll just wipe out the law and change it completely. But, Paul, in terms of the commercial activities tax, which is not corporate activities tax in Ohio, right, it flows down farther than just corporations, correct?
Yes. The way that the commercial activity tax is not a income tax. It's not a corporate income tax. It is a business privilege tax for the privilege of making sales in Ohio. So anybody who has over 100, if you look on that form, anybody has over $150,000 in gross receipts from sales in Ohio has to file that form.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
So regardless of the entity type, whether it's a proprietor or any business entity.
Right. So therefore, back to my original question, if you were doing a B&O like Washington, if you want to say that, or a commercial activities tax or a privilege tax like you're saying, I mean, you're down to one page here. It unfortunately, well, just for sake of discussion, I know my good colleague in the same caucus raised the issue of, you know, individual proprietors. It doesn't matter. I mean, if you do something like a commercial activities tax, even though we're going to wipe out the in lieu of a corporate tax, if you did that type of structure, it's going to flow all the way down. It's going to impact more than just what says corporation in the tax expenditure budget.
Absolutely.
And we, of course, in my point in the discussions of these 3 tax credits, is you have to figure out that implication. I mean, if you have a contractual obligation in this, the report's first and foremost, in my mind, is going to get much more complex. Let's say you went to a CAT, you did this. It's going to get much more complex and thicker in the first 3 years because now suddenly you got to figure out good examples, the one we just hit here with the banks. that are getting, you know, this interest credit. You know, have this contractual thing, and you got to figure out, you know, how do we hold harmless if we're going to change the law, but how do we hold harmless in the line going out in front of for something that was previously in there? And so it's even more complex than just saying we're going to sunset them in 2, 4, or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Vice Chair, I think that's absolutely right, that you make a transition. There would be a transition period if you're going to a major structural change like that. But what you would do, and if for example, the corporate income tax were to be eliminated starting with corporate tax year 2018, then of course you would not be, those credits would not be able to be applied against those future years, but they would still be on the books for the prior years and could be used in the case of amended returns, or could be used in any situation involving audits on those years.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Okay, so I've got, let's just hypothetically, so we understand that the tax expenditure report and its credits would work in theory against something like the commercial activities tax. The information that we have in this book right now gives us this line and what it's doing. And so if you said 2018 is the magic date, you know, you could say, one, they all go away, just what happens, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's done, finished. And if you want to come back and get a credit against, in the future, against your privilege tax, right, then we'll take them one by one. I guess my question is sort of like, how did they address this in these other takes, Nevada, Texas, and Ohio? How did they address that issue? Because you could, in fact, turn around and say, you can get a deduction on your privilege tax, you know, okay. And we'll just use, and I'm not picking on them, we'll use the low-income housing one here, which is 1%. Mm-hmm. You can get up to a 4%, you know, deduction. Well, it's not one for one, and I can make that argument pretty quickly. There is a benefit to the financial institutions, it appears to be, and that's what I was trying to get at my question here. But if you went into that tax credit hypothetically by itself and said, okay, the benefit is X, but we don't want them to lose any money because, you know, they're helping in the low-income income, to hold that harmless, you could go in and either change that formula line by line through every one of these bloody tax credits, or you could then set the date at 2018 and say, this is the list of credits, we got to go back and figure out what we're going to do to hold, if that was our policy decision, to hold them harmless through the value. Now, how did they do it in Ohio? Did they just say, all your credits are bloody well gone, and through low-income, just as an example, through low-income housing, said, nope, we're not going to do it anymore.
Mr. Vice Chair, I don't know how they did it in Ohio. They do have some credits now against the commercial activity tax, and they of course retain their personal income tax. They also have a retail sales tax. So what they eliminated was the corporate income tax. We can go back and look and see how they handled that transition. But one of their arguments for making the change, one of their primary arguments was the simplification that you talked about, that going from a corporate income tax, which through, as you heard yesterday from Chris about the issues around apportionment and so forth, is, you know, makes that a relatively complex tax, whereas the commercial activity tax is a lot more straightforward in terms of its calculation. And that was one of their arguments for making the change. But if you're going to do a transition, there would be some things you'd want to think about in terms of what are the policy choices going forward. You have lots of credits still out there. You still certainly have a lot of the business energy tax credits are out there that are available, and those have a long carry forward. And they're 5-year credits to begin with, plus they have an 8-year carry forward. So those are going to be on the books for a while, and so the policy decision would be, you know, do you allow them in some phased out sense over time so that you can use, you know, X proportion over in certain years so that they would gradually phase down to zero where they're no longer could be counted against the new tax.
And
or
if
you
can
count it against the new base would be another way to do it.
And these would be the kinds of things that would come into the review process if LRO and the department did this, and it wouldn't go into effect for 3 months after the session, in which case we would know whether we do the CAT tax or not. And all that would be figured in, and you would have your recommendations February 28th, 2018.
Well, we could certainly discuss some of those issues, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And, you know, this one of the things you do have in this one is the new Chapter 16, which is the marijuana tax. So that's the latest chapter.
Question in my left.
So I don't think you're
your book's going to get any thicker, Senator Boquist. Senator Taylor?
I just have a question for Paul. So if we were to do this, how, in order to make certain, let's just take the example we have in front of us, where we're preventing, where we're providing, you know, rent assistance for folks, trickling all the way down to make certain that this type of thing goes on, assuming that we want that policy-wise, how do we, I don't see how we can do that without increasing the credits in the, or, and or the deductions in the personal income tax realm. I mean, is there, there isn't really any other way to get down to these types of programs without doing that, unless I'm asking, is there any other way to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, you're thinking about any way to use those kind of incentives if you don't have the corporate income tax anymore.
Yeah.
There definitely are ways you could do that through any, your tax base. I mean, you can create credits, or you can exempt certain activities.
But I mean, it has to be made up for in another way. If we got rid of the corporate tax, you would have to create these other programs to have the impact actually be felt by individuals, like in this case of the rent assistance kind of thing.
Well, that's true. You would have to look at how it affects how that base affects different individuals and different markets. But for example, one of the decisions, as I mentioned, with the nonprofits, one of the decisions you have to make right away with a gross receipts base is what is it you're going to exempt. So if you exempt that, so those businesses wouldn't be paying corporate income tax if they were corporate income tax affected. But you could exempt them from paying the gross receipts tax, so that in itself would act as an incentive. Or you can create credits for those that are profit and normally subject to the new tax. You could create credits for them to do certain things that would reduce their tax bill, and you know, basically that's up to you, and that would create a whole new base. And from that base, then you've got to weigh the same trade-offs you do now when you look at the tax expenditures. And the trade-offs are you lose revenue from what you would have had if you narrow the base, and two, if it's not prepared correctly, you end up complicating the system. So you'll have those same decisions to make, but it'll be just in a new structure.
Chair Hess.
Senator Riley.
And, Paul, another option is we could give them money out of the budget.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, and you know, one of the real motives behind the tax expenditure report and why states have gone to this over the last 30 years or so is for that very reason, that it's the other side of the fiscal coin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's expenditures and tax expenditures. I mean, they're different mechanisms, but oftentimes they have some of the same objectives. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, Chris has tried to include some expenditure side elements that relate to the credit or the purpose of the credit, so you can get a more holistic view of things, and that's one of the main reasons behind this. So definitely.
Mm-hmm.
In an effort to close at 10 o'clock, Mr. Fitzpatrick, do you have any parting words?
No.
Or Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald, whichever.
It's Tim. I didn't figure out whether it was Patrick.
I thought that was our insider joke.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a suggestion. Actually, it's not a request, because I'm not really sure I want to know the answer. But here's a suggestion. We might want to have LRO go back to the commercial activities tax in Ohio and look at the top 10 corporate or tax credits they have. Go back to ours, look at our top 10 corporate or individual tax credits, and find three that have a commonality between Oregon and Ohio, and have them look at it and say, what did they do in Ohio when they went to the CAT with these three credits, to give us three real-world examples of how they addressed this particular issue.
So look at that and decide if we want to know.
Right.
Okay.
We do have contacts.
I mean, that's a suggestion, because this is something we're going to have to obviously wrestle with.
Yeah.
If we're going to go down this road.
Oh, yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, unless I'm missing something about schedule, we're actually thinking about what the road looks like in front of us long before February of 2018. So that's why I raised the issue on this particular tax expenditure bill.
Okay, good discussion. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Tomorrow, back at the regular time of 8:30. No meeting Friday, meeting Monday, no meeting Tuesday, forecast on Wednesday.
Well, let me confirm the Tuesday with them.
Okay.
So I'll confirm that, and then we'll let the members know right away.
Okay. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.